Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Accelerate Your Business Growth,
where we're exploring all sorts of business topics. Experts from around the world join me, your host, Diane Helbig, for a conversation where they share their expertise with all of you. Take what you need when you need it. Featured on Inc.com, Forbes, and MSNBC's Your Business, this podcast is recognized as one of the best podcasts for small business, sales, leadership, social media, and more. When it comes to business, Accelerate Your Business Growth has got it covered. And now on with the show. My guest today is Leo Battari. Leo is the founder and managing partner of Peernovation LLC and co-founder of The One Advantage. Leo is an award-winning author of three books, including Peernovation, What Peer Advisory Groups Can Teach Us About Building High-Performing Teams, that published in 2020. He's also a keynote speaker, podcaster, workshop facilitator, advisory board member, and opinion columnist for CEO World Magazine, and adjunct professor for Rutgers University. Thanks so much for joining me today, Leo.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
Well, I am thrilled to have you here. We're going to be talking about leadership, which is one of my favorite topics, get more so every day. And I want to start by asking you what you believe are the fundamentals of great leadership.
Oh, thanks for asking. I will tell you that I have been a real follower of Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner for quite some time. Of course, their first book, or at least the first edition of The Leadership Challenge, was written in 1987. And it was largely based on interviews where they were asking people, as a leader, what were the kinds of practices, what were the things that you were doing that you believe reflected your best self as a leader? And you know, time and time again, the same five exemplary practices kept coming up. And they were model the way, inspiring a shared vision, challenging the process, enabling others to act, and encouraging the heart, which obviously I think is really super important to, you know, make sure people feel appreciated and celebrated. So I think those five practices have really stood the test of time, and they've certainly rung true for me and for the incredible leaders that I work with all the time with CEO peer groups and in companies around the world.
Yeah, I love those fundamentals. And I think the heart really is so incredibly important, and something that I'm not sure in the past, you know, far past, you know, probably earlier than the 70s, was necessarily a thing. Do you think it was, or has that evolved?
No, I think it's evolved quite a bit. I think a lot has changed in the world. I mean, just think about, what's changed, globally. You know, when you consider, authoritarian rule and everything from, protests for freer elections in Poland to peaceful uprisings in the neighboring countries to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, this idea of, trying to basically, force people, whether it was how they live or how they work, in any way, this whole command and control notion of leadership, I think has changed quite a bit. And, in many respects, you asked me about these leadership practices that I may think are, really essential, you know, for leaders. And I think those five practices have held up well. And if you think about it, those practices haven't changed a lot at all. In fact, I think it's much more about how people want to be led than anything else. Again, I think there's some global considerations there. I think how we're parented and how we parent today versus, you know, a few generations ago, where everything was kind of about, if it wasn't your parent, your teacher, your priest or minister or whatever, there was this boss that was pretty much telling you what you were supposed to do and you didn't have a lot of voice. Today, that's not the case. You know, kids are parented in a way where parents actually listen to their kids. And they recognize that kids are brought up in a completely different world than what they grow up in. And we have a lot to learn from our children in that respect, in terms of how they see the world. So I think that's translated into companies today where leaders are listening, employees are actually able to offer immediate value. It is no longer a situation where you've got to be there for 5, 10 plus years to learn the ropes from, you know, an elder. You come in oftentimes with real incredible skills, particularly around digital, social media, collaboration, a number of areas where, you know, young people come into the workplace and offering and providing immediate value. And I think that's changed the dynamic, you know, incredibly.
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad that you said that. It's whenever I hear people complaining about millennials and what I always say to them, okay, hang on a second. We raised them. So if you're going to be upset with anybody, let's all just be upset with ourselves, because we're the ones who created these humans, you know, who want more out of a work environment and are more socially conscious. And, you know, all of these I consider to be great things about the, you know, these generations.
Well, I think we've got everything to be proud of. I don't think we have to apologize for anything in that regard. I've got two daughters that are in their early 30s. I teach graduate school, as you mentioned, for Rutgers University, where I work with young people all the time, whether it's millennials or now Gen Zs. And I think it's an extraordinary generation. I think they get a bad rap and it becomes, you know, a convenient kind of way to talk about them in terms of being entitled and all these other kinds of things. And I think the reality is that I love how they see the world. I every once in a while, I'd kind of describe it from a perspective of when I grew up, we were taught, you know, good things come to those who wait. My daughters will tell you that good things come to those who act, and they are more purposeful, and they are more, I mean, it's just an entirely different, again, entirely different world they grew up in. And I think in many respects, we have been as parents smart to listen to them, to learn from them. And I think the more we continue to do that, they're not going to be like us. We weren't like our parents and they weren't like their parents. Right. You know, I read one time that even, you know, Plato, you know, back in the day, right, was concerned about, boy, that next generation, the world's just going to fall apart once they take over. And somehow, you know, we've all managed to do okay. So I think the next generation and generations to come are going to do some extraordinary things.
I do too. I'm totally with you. So let's talk some about how they want to be led, because it's different, isn't it, from how boomers want to be led?
Yeah. Or I'm not sure want, but at least boomers were used to being led, you know, in a pretty rough way for a long time. But, you know, I think this idea of real inclusive leadership is really important. People want to be included. They want to be part of the decision-making process. And when we do that, we also make them part and engaged in the success of whatever initiative we've all worked on together. So sometimes it may take you a little longer to reach a plan of action, but when you do, and everyone looks each other in the eye and says, this is great, this is going to work, and now we have that stake in the outcome, we have that connection to what we're doing here. It wasn't someone told us to do it. We own the solution. And when that happens, it makes a big, big difference. And so I think one of the big things is that young people want to be heard. That doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with every single thing that anyone says or does in that regard. But I think if people, you know, all of us really, if we feel we've been heard, if we've made our case, we recognize sometimes that we don't always have the full picture. We're not seeing the entire chessboard, you know, over time. And this is where, you know, we have trust our leaders that they've heard us. They recognize that our ideas come from a particular perspective and vantage point, and that this is where, you know, we have to trust one another. So, you know, I think being part of the process is really important. Think about now the challenges that have been facing leaders who had everyone working remotely, and now you've got a bunch of leaders who are saying, all right, starting Monday, everyone's back in the office 5 days a week. Yeah. And everyone else is like, well, wait a second now. Hold on there. You know, we should talk about this first, because we all did pretty well, you know, for a lot of this. And you've got employees now who have choices, and with the balance of power shifted, and that, and maybe it's okay. And that even though there's a lot of leaders that won't love it, that they have to kind of listen and they have to invite these folks to the table. They'll be grateful they did once, you know, this all kind of fleshes out, and maybe together they can write that next chapter of the future of work.
It feels to me, and it has felt to me for a little while now, you know, probably at least the past couple of years, that older leaders, you know, so boomers who lead, are having a difficult time shifting, you know, process and beliefs, because it's so ingrained, where younger leaders, it is part of how they have grown up. So it's more natural for them. Is that fair?
It's very fair. Well, think about it this way. So I'll put it in my, so when I went to school, you know, I'm in high school, college, or whatever, it involved a teacher / lecturer, professor, whatever you want to call them, in the front of the room, you know, telling you things, you taking notes, taking tests, writing papers, doing that kind of stuff. Back then, for me, your collaborative learning would have been called cheating, essentially, right? Everyone's, you know, they're shading their papers, they're doing all these other kinds of things. Well, when you grow up and your learning experience is collaborative, again, you've built muscles around being able to do that in ways that I think are pretty extraordinary. You care about different things. You grow up in a very different system, a very different way of thinking. When I talk with many CEOs, as you described, you know, boomers who really have a difficult time squaring the idea that they don't care about the same things I care about, and I don't know how to bridge that gap. I don't know how to really listen and really try to see the world from their perspective. And it is really difficult. So you've got to work at it. Conversely, I think that millennials have to do the same, that they have to realize that the people they report to were shaped by a very different world. And the better they understand one another, the more opportunities they're going to have to have meaningful, intentional conversations where they can at least understand one another better, which I think would be a wonderful start.
Yeah, I do too. It feels like it all starts with everybody listening first.
Yes, how about that?
Yeah.
And listening and listening for understanding, though, you know,
right.
It is Covey's thing, right? Seek first to understand, then to be understood.
Yeah.
It's not about trying to listening so you can frame your argument about why they're wrong. It's
right.
A listening from a place of curiosity, a real place of wanting to understand. And, you know, we weren't very well equipped for that either. In my second book, What Anyone Can Do, I remember raising this idea that, okay, I'll go back to when I was growing up, you know, parents would tell us things like, oh, whatever you do, don't have conversations with people about politics or religion, right? Because why? Because it was set up for a fight, you know? Now, of course, they're trying to ease social situations. I think they're trying to protect the nascent views of young kids who have values that are shaped at home that parents don't want people tinkering around with too much. But, you know, the reality is that when we don't look at those as opportunities for understanding, when we think they're just simply setups for conflict, that becomes a problem. I mean, imagine if we lived in a world where we could ask and really have great meaningful conversations about people's faith and the role it plays in their life and what that means for them, or to understand whether someone's Democrat or Republican. Where does that come from for you? What are the things that have shaped the way you see the world, and what does that look like? You don't have to agree with them, you know, but to actually become really educated and try to develop an understanding of what this is all about, as opposed to having it be, you know, fodder for conflict. And unfortunately, it's not just politics and religion anymore. It's all kinds of stuff that people can't talk about. And I think that's really been, you know, problematic. And I hope that we come to a place where we start, you know, doing some things that help us dialogue a little more effectively than that. We can be a little more curious, you know, that we can try to be, you know, that line where to try to be interested before we try to be interesting. That would be great, right?
It really would be great. I just keep saying to my children who are in their 20s, I'm just, you know, banking on you guys to fix all the stuff that we broke, you know?
No kidding.
Because I don't know that my generation has any interest in listening, but their generation is so tolerant and unbiased and just, you know, doesn't understand all of this insanity. They need to be in charge.
Sure. They do. I think that's 100% right. I think there's a lot of things that we've screwed up. I'm not sure either if any of us were prepared. I mean, think about it. I mean, the numbers are roughly correct. So that if you look at the population in this world, it has just about tripled since 1950. So think about that and think about how exponentially more quickly this is about to happen going forward. The impact that all of us have on this planet in every way, shape, or form is something that we have to think about, something we have to plan for. And unless we have a generation right now stepping in and stepping up and doing what we didn't in that regard, I think it's you know, crucial.
Yeah, I do too. Well, so I'm going to ask you a question about the workplace, and in my brain, I'm sort of curious about if it then translates to, you know, the greater society. But my question is this: what are the pluses of having five generations in today's workforce?
Well, it could be a plus if we can actually all listen and learn from one another. I think it's incredible. I mean, think about that. I mean, think about how that's amazing, right?
Yeah.
That you can have a situation like that. So I think the more that everybody, and this is kind of what I went and talked about before in terms of, it isn't just about boomers trying to understand millennials. It's got to be the other way around as well. And I think now when you broaden it to the five generation scenario, what an incredible learning opportunity that is. You know, it's kind of amazing. And by the way, I've met some extraordinary people. I'll mention one gentleman. So back when I was working for Vistage, which, as you know, they assemble and facilitate peer advisory groups for, you know, CEOs, you know, in the US and around the world, there was a gentleman, his name was Pat Hyndman. Now, Pat Hyndman was a very successful career. He had done more things by his early 70s than most people could do in three lifetimes. And yet at the age of 73, he decides, hey, I'm going to take on a new career, and decides that he's going to be a leader of these Vistage groups of CEOs. So the guy does this for 25 years. I mean, think about that. Regards it as the most meaningful, you know, part of his career. And, you know, he basically talked in terms of, you know what? He says, you don't, you know, grow old. He said, you become old when you stop growing. And he was very much about learning from others, learning from young people, of course, being able to hear stories from him, you know, during times where, you know, when watching Babe Ruth play and things like that. I mean, it was just unbelievable, right? So in business or in life, or sports, or all of the experiences he had growing up were just amazing. And conversely, what he would also do is he would come into the office all the time and be trying to stay up on all the new technology so that when he was running that technology in his meetings, he didn't look like the 98-year-old guy who didn't know what he was doing with it. He was all over it. He was on top of it. His presence, his voice, his strength of personality, his whole persona in front of a group was 20 or 30 years his junior. And I think it had so much to do with that level of curiosity and wisdom and understanding that he had across, and he's got groups, of course, where there were several generations of CEOs, even in that situation, but in an environment where they could truly talk and learn from one another, it was amazing. So, you know, I think anyone who's lucky enough to be in a workplace that has that kind of representation in there should be all about how much can I learn from everyone all around me every day, no matter who they are, how old they are, where they come from, you know, all of it. We have something to learn from everybody.
Yeah, it's for sure. And we have to get out of this. We have to be more open-minded. I mean, curiosity is my favorite thing. I think when we lead with curiosity, it just opens up everything and makes us more connected to people, and we make better decisions, or we participate in better decision-making. I really liked what you said about, you know, when people are part of the process, then they have buy-in, you know, then they, it's going to work because it's theirs.
That's right.
Right. And so there's a big difference between being told and being included.
Yeah. I knew that wasn't going to work, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what tends to happen. But when you own the solution, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. Don't you know that you're
a grown-up? I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, genxgrownup.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right. I've never done it. Right.
Welcome, change agents, to your go-to place for stories that ignite your spirit, fuel your purpose, and connect us all. We believe in the incredible power of the human spirit, its boundless resilience, and the inspiration it brings to our lives. On the Driving Change podcast, we'll journey together through the extraordinary yet very relatable experiences of some of the most amazing people on earth. Our mission? That through these stories, we might just spark change within you and awaken a newfound motivation to harness your unique gifts to make a real difference in the world. So get ready to be inspired and join us on this incredible adventure. You can find the Driving Change podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you love listening to your favorite podcasts.
I am curious if you think that changes in our like political leadership have affected this dynamic of how people want to be led.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It's also changed our ability to have dialogue in this country, and not in a good way. And by the way, and I not only speak, you know, for Vistage groups and all that, but all different peer groups all over, as well as working, you know, with different companies. And what's interesting about this, and the reason I say that is because I don't want anything attributed to any specific, you know, group or team or anything like that. But the reality is that there are some groups, and this is among CEOs now, where the efficacy of the group has actually been compromised by the fact that the members come together and they just don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to step on any toes. They don't want to challenge anyone. They don't want to do anything. And it becomes all about just trying to completely play it safe. And it actually really compromises the very reason they're there, which is to, you know, really in a healthy, positive way, challenge one another to basically, you know, achieve what they most cases have expressed they already want for themselves. Conversely, there have been fistfights in CEO group meetings. Yes. And it is, I mean, something else when you start thinking about that and the fact that things have gotten so tense and so heightened and everybody's on a hair trigger. And we have what, and I think an interesting expression that was used by the Edelman Trust Barometer among a number of years ago, and they continue to use it, is that we really have poor information hygiene, right? Whenever we hear something that tends to conform with our worldview, we will spread that information without vetting it first.
Yeah, right.
And this is where you have all of these things that are coming out there and all these, you know, crazy scenarios and all the stuff that people are sharing and spreading all over the place in a way that's just really harmful. That, you know, we used to, you know, back, and this is a long time ago now, so if you went back in the 80s, well, no, not even, you know, but you go back in the 80s, you know, when people go back to the days and they talk about Reagan being president and Tip O'Neill and the fact that they could still have a drink together at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But the point is that back then, there was never really a question about it. It was always kind of understood that, hey, Republicans and Democrats, they want a good result for the country. They just have a different way of going about it. They have a different way of trying to get there. And it was bridging those gaps. Now we can't even agree in the same set of facts about anything, let alone motive or intent or any of these other things. And it's caused incredible problems, and it has infected a lot of what happens with dialogue today. Now, on the flip side of that, we also just went through, here we are, COVID, kind of on the backside of this now, where at the same time we have this incredible political divisiveness. I think there's not nearly enough talked about with the incredible generosity and spirit that people have toward one another, that they're giving to their neighbors and to their friends how what it's done in families and all that, I think has been rather extraordinary. So we have some really good things going on and a lot of really good people out there in this world. And by the same token, we have, you know, this other, you know, information pandemic, if you will, this inability to, you know, engage in productive exchanges with one another. That is no small thing. And we're going to have to work really hard to fix that.
Well, people are going to have to want to work really hard to fix that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the difficulty is when we only hang around with people who agree with us, then we really don't have much of an incentive to try to, you know, deal with the other. So yeah, that's a problem. And
that's gotten worse since all of this.
When we think about it, a lot of the people, when they complain about Congress, they talk about gerrymandering and what that's done as far as deeply entrenching members of Congress, whether it was no matter what side you're talking about,
right,
you know, into the extremes of their specific positions. And so I'm not sure that we don't personally gerrymander our own lives by trying to, you know, just only connect ourselves with people who are like-minded in that way. And we have to do a better job of trying to reach out, you know, beyond that. But again, you know, we have to be able to have the kind of productive dialogue that's going to make that helpful.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree with you. And one of the things that goes on in my head is I think we have to go back to what is the goal, because I feel like we move the goal all the time. When it's agree with me, that becomes the goal, not whatever it is I'm trying to accomplish over here or whatever I believe in or whatever it is. It's the goal is now you have to be on my side,
sure,
with me, right? And so if we can break it down and say, okay, hang on a second, you know, like in a business, what are really the goals of the business? Okay, so then now what needs to happen in order for those goals to be met? Then it takes the emotion out of it and allows us to focus in a place that, you know, feels like it shouldn't be so volatile.
Yeah, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with conflict. You know, conflict can be really good. Conflict, when it's done well, we can learn a lot. And to your point about goals and purpose, you know, years ago when I worked at Mullen Lowe, it was a pretty combative environment. What people didn't realize when you look at it from the outside is that people weren't fighting against each other. They were fighting for the best idea. They recognized that what they were there to do was challenge one another. They actually had incredible mutual respect for each other. They knew if they challenged each other, the more they did that, the better the work got. And that's why they were all there. They were there to maximize their potential as a professional, as an individual, and be part of an ensemble that, if they did their job, was capable of creating the best advertising in the world. And that's why they were there and why they wanted to be part of it. So the conflict part of it was actually, people got worked up because they cared, but they were listening. And you work together because the work is what it was all about. I used to love the way that the standard on that, by the way, was framed by Edward Boches, who was the executive creative director at the time, who basically said that, you know, good work tells you what a product does and why you should buy it. Great work conveys what a brand stands for and invites you to share in its beliefs. So now you not only have a goal, a purpose, you have even a higher standard. You have something that you are shooting for that you want to self-identify with being a part of. And so I'd like to hope that we could create that kind of a construct, you know, for this country. We're actually getting things done, recognizing who we are, what our purpose is, and what it's all about.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm with that. I like that. And one of the things that I hear in that is the mutual respect. You know, that's the foundation. Everyone started from a point of respecting each other.
You know, you hear a lot of people talk about freedom, with this idea of what that means and all of that. I think the more operative word we should be using is liberty. Liberty, as you may know, is just the responsible exercise of freedom. It's recognizing that in the pursuit of exercising my freedom, I recognize that other people have it too. And I can't infringe upon that, right? So, you know, I wish we could kind of get to more of an understanding from a terminology standpoint that, you know, freedom at least developed that connotation of liberty, not the connotation of, hey, I can do whatever the heck I want.
I'm so glad that you said that. It has pained me for the past couple of years that people have forgotten that we are a community and that we are responsible for how we impact our community. You know, everyone's gone to their corners and is so, you know, they have blinders on around the whys. You know, why would you do it? Well, because it's good for someone else. Like, really, is that so tough? But
Yeah. We do live in a society, you know.
Right. So. Right. Exactly. About that. What we used to. I mean, you know, we used to have an understanding of that. And that feels like that's sort of gone by the wayside, but we'll see.
Well, COVID tested that for a lot of people.
Sure did. Sure did. Yep. And in my opinion, a lack of great leadership just, you know, lit the fuse. Because leadership really could have done an awful lot to send the right messages and to rally the troops. And it was really up to individuals to sort of, you know, swim on their own. So,
You know, hasn't typically been the role of presidents to try to divide the country during moments where we really needed to band together. Yeah, so, right. You know, there is that. Yes. Is what it is. And we've got to do better, and everybody's got to do better. What happened in Texas the other day is profoundly, sad doesn't begin to touch it. But I think everybody should be really angry. Everybody should be really like, too. You know what? This is just, you know, unless people believe Americans are homicidal by nature, right? As opposed to any other country in the world.
Right.
We've got to deal with this issue. And people have different views about how to deal with it, but since no one's doing anything,
right.
and it's been part of every presidency,
yep.
you know, for just about as long as most of us can remember,
yeah.
we can't allow that to happen anymore. And no parent in their right mind is going to want to send their kids to school. And how horrifying,
oh my gosh.
You know, how horrifying is that?
Well, and the other part of it is that people are forgetting that there are living victims, right? I mean, those children who experienced watching their classmates get slaughtered, I heard a guy on the news who wrote a book, you know, he studied this, he researched the impact that this sort of trauma has on children. It's, you know, I don't understand how we can sit here and sort of treat it, say it's unacceptable, but treat it like it's acceptable.
Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, people will get, you know, appropriately outraged for yeah. about a week and yeah. then, you know, it'll kind of right. go back. And let's face it, this is on the heels, you know, of a, you know, prior tragedy in Buffalo. It's
California.
It is. It's just going on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's ridiculous. See, this is, this whole leadership thing for me, that leaders make tough choices, or they make make decisions for the greater good, not for their own, you know, for what's expedient for them. Supposedly, I mean, this is, you know,
that's not only absolutely correct, it's publicly acknowledged. Like people with a straight face will say, yeah, well, he's not going to vote for that because it could cost them their job. I'd love to know why it is that anyone wants a job that doesn't actually afford them the opportunity to do their job, right? So they become, you know, subservient to lobbyists and other, you know, special interests. And I don't know why you'd want it, you know, because unless you're willing to have the courage to stand up for what's right during times when it's most difficult, I don't know what you're doing there.
Me either. So, I know. I'm totally with you, and I think it requires the citizenry to say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. Because unless we do, they have no incentive. People are going to vote them right back into office. And we have to stand up and say, seriously, we're done. And just hound the hell out of them until they realize we mean it.
Yeah, you know, this is where, you know, it just literally made me think of when you talked about the leadership issue here. You go right down the row, right? Modeling the way, inspiring a shared vision, challenging the process, enabling others to act, and encouraging the heart. Let's get us some leaders, you know, who are doing those five things.
Yes.
And we're going to be in a different situation. But
exactly.
That's not the world that we're living in right now, but we're also not entirely separate from it. We are voting these people into office.
Right.
And so
we're condoning it. We're absolutely yep. condoning this. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, we know. Oh my gosh. I am so glad we had this conversation today. Thank you. I feel sort of like I just had a therapy session. So
there you go. Yeah, I kind of went in a bit of a, you know, a bigger, broader direction, but that's good.
It had
you know?
To.
And it's nice to, you know, again, to be able to share this thing and, you know, not in a partisan way, this is the state of things.
Yes.
And you know, it's got to change.
Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, believe me, I they're all to blame as far as I'm concerned. So Leo, will you please tell the listeners, you know, how they can find you, how they can get your books, whatever you've got going on, please.
Sure. So they can go to my website at leobottari.com, leobottari.com, where they can basically learn about peer innovation, which is the subject of my third book, which is what peer advisory groups can teach us about building high-performing teams. I'd spent about a decade or more basically studying business peer advisory groups from around the world. We took a lot of their best practices in my first book and in the second book that I wrote. It was pretty much all about the whole group of people who surround us, our parents, teachers, mentors, family, friends, and all of that, with the idea that, you know, when you look at really successful people in life, it isn't that they're capable of superhuman feats. They can't leap tall buildings in a single bound. They just do the things that anyone can do that most of us never will. And if we can surround ourselves with the right people, they can help us do those little things that anyone can do far more often. But leaping to this idea of peer advisory groups and how the really high performing ones do what they do so well, it's being able to capture those principles and bring those into your teams. And I don't think there's ever been a more important time to be bringing those teams together, having intentional conversations that create clarity and real unity and real empowerment, for folks where together we can start writing the next chapter of our future of work and be all in it together.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for the work you do and for spending some time with me and my listeners, helping us get educated on all of this. I appreciate it. And listeners, I appreciate you. You are who we're doing this for. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Accelerate Your Business Growth, a production of Evergreen Podcasts. Discover more episodes of this podcast and explore others at evergreenpodcast.com. As always, continue to prosper and be curious. And if you're looking to get your sales strategy headed in the right direction, pick up a copy of Succeed Without Selling on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Until we meet again on another episode of Accelerate Your Business Growth, goodbye and good day.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.